That's the opening movement from the Symphony No. 1 by Sergei Prokofiev, known commonly as his Classical Symphony, a performance by the Philadelphia Orchestra conducted by Riccardo Muti. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, the show's your connection to local performances. And on our program today, coming up, we'll have a few musicians playing live in our studio who will be representing a program called The Musicians of St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Urbana. They're giving a concert Sunday afternoon, and quite an interesting and varied program, which will represent with, as I say, three of their performers. But first, that music will open a concert by Sinfonia da Camera, the chamber orchestra based at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. And they're giving a concert tonight called From Russia with Love. Ian Hobson is music director and will conduct that concert. And he's welcoming guest violinist Andres Cardenas, who is my guest this first portion of Live and Local, and sort of a repeat appearance on the show. Thanks very much for coming in.
Well, pleasure to be here.
Last time you were here, and my first chance to meet you in person, you and Ian and U of I horn professor Bernard Scully gave us a performance of the final movement of the Brahms Horn Trio, which you were performing in. I don't remember what was the occasion when you were here.
I think it was just a recital of Bernard's, and we were just playing on his recital, and he invited me to come and play.
I wonder if that was also part of Ian's Brahms Chamber Music Program series.
It could be. We played it in November, actually. November, October, and just last year. So just a few months ago is when we last played it.
Yeah, that's right. So you did it twice. You probably did it on Bernard's recital and then on Ian's recital.
Yeah.
Well, I first encountered your name for myself personally as a violinist in a recording that I'll sample in just a minute, which was a wonderful one. It's called Made in the USA, and there's lots of music that I'd never heard of by some composers that I didn't know much about, if I'd even heard of them at all. But for the longest time, you were the concertmaster of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, where you also have done conducting there. And that is it fair to say that your conducting career got launched through your association with Pittsburgh, or was that happening? Did it precede your tenure there as concertmaster?
Well, a little bit of both. You know, I had been conducting and taking formal lessons since I was 15, but by the time I got to college, I really started to concentrate on violin playing. There were many international competitions that I wanted to participate in and try to win. And once I got out of that, I immediately got some jobs playing concertmaster and soloing. And so my conducting kind of went by the wayside. But it was a good thing in a lot of ways, because sitting concertmaster for 21 years with the Pittsburgh Symphony, you know, I got mentored by a lot of great conductors and spent a lot of time with them talking about the scores and learning a lot about how they rehearse and what their technique was, and I got so many musical ideas and so much experience watching how they rehearse and how they handle people that it really did me very well to have that kind of mentorship time. And in 1999, they created the Pittsburgh Symphony Chamber Orchestra for me, and then that's when I started to really start conducting quite a bit more.
Since you mentioned being mentored, at least for the time these conductors were visiting the orchestra, the guests, and I assume the music directors. Can you give a couple of examples maybe of some things you learned from specific ones and what you found particularly valuable?
Well, I think, for instance, if I took somebody like Lauren Mazel and Leonard Slatkin, I would find them to be two of the finest rehearsal conductors, meaning they knew how to budget their time really well, how to give comments that were relevant, instructive, and to the point without wasting a lot of time. They rehearsed things that needed rehearsing, and they were very efficient. So I learned that a lot of times talking and getting into minutia was not conducive to really creating a good rehearsal atmosphere, and you don't get as good a result when you're nitpicking things. So I learned that from them. More musical things, Rafael Frubeck de Burgos is one of my favorite conductors. Mm. Frubeck, he and I became very, very close friends, and we were rehearsing the Debussy Nocturnes one day. And for the first time in my life, there's a little trumpet fanfare in one of the movements, and it was the first time I ever heard it really quiet. It's supposed to be pianissimo, very quiet, and always the trumpets had trouble playing them very quiet. Either they started cracking, or it wasn't together, or it was forced. And I asked him, I said, how did you get them to play so quietly? He said, I told them to use a different kind of mute on the trumpet. They were using a certain kind of mute, and he told them to use a Harmon mute. And that mute, it mutes the trumpet so much that they could actually blow into the trumpet comfortably, and it still comes out very quiet. And it gives the trumpet player a comfort zone to be able to just play it without having to worry about playing so quietly. That's another example of just orchestral technique that was very valuable. And, of course, we had conductors such as Charles Dutoit, who I really enjoyed working with. He was a bit of a nitpicker. You know, he could get bogged down a little bit in small details. But he always had a great grand vision for everything that he ever conducted. And I loved the way he architecturally constructed and deconstructed works. And so I learned a lot from him about shaping a large work. And then we had a lot of conductors, I have to say, not a lot, but a few conductors that I thought were not very good. And I learned an awful lot from them about what not to do.
We don't need to name those.
No, we don't need to name them. But I learned exactly what not to do in those cases. We had one conductor, for instance, who insisted on a certain tempo of a contemporary work we were doing. And really, we had a virtuoso orchestra, but the tempo was just too fast. It didn't give the brass players enough time to recover for each phrase, and they were gasping and turning red and trying to keep up, and he did not acquiesce for 1 second. So what happened? Instead of giving in 3%, he insisted, and then the performance wasn't very good, and the brass players were gassed, they were tired, and they just couldn't play their best. And in the pursuit of playing a good performance, sometimes there's a little give and take. You have to understand what the limitations are. But this conductor just wouldn't give in. And I thought, now that's something you don't want to do. the performance suffered because of it. Other conductors are very slow moving, or they come in and they don't have a concept of what they want to do. So they always look to the principals or to players in the orchestra for advice. And I learned very quickly, the minute you start looking around for advice, it's like you lose the troops. They need a leader. They need somebody who has a very, very pronounced and definite architectural plan for how they want to rehearse, how they want to play the piece, how they want it to sound, how they want to pace the rehearsal. And so, you know, you learn a lot about what not to do as well.
What have you learned from some of the great conductors you've worked with about violin playing that you didn't know in your training until you maybe heard something from them you hadn't heard before?
Well, I must say that that's a little bit of a trickier question, because about violin playing per se, the intricacies of playing violin, I don't think I necessarily learned an awful lot from conductors about how to play the instrument. But what I did learn was, for instance, what was more traditionally useful in terms of, let's say, bowings. For instance, if you're playing by yourself and you're playing a solo piece, you can arrange the bowings, you know, the direction that you take in the bow. You arrange them based on your ability and your talent and also how well it sounds when you do it. But when you play in an orchestra, you have to take into consideration you have 15 first violin players, 15 second violin players, and if the rest of the string players are playing the same music as you are, they all have to play the same bowing. So what may be comfortable, virtuosic, and productive for you may not be for 50 other people, you know? So you have to be able to find a bowing that works for everyone that still somehow gets the result you're looking for. And so conductors would kind of often tell me, you know, I like what you're doing, but it would serve the whole orchestra better if you did a bowing that everybody could play comfortably. And that's one thing that I did learn from, particularly Lauren Mazel. He was just a master in every way.
And he was a violinist.
He was a violinist. And so he knew what he was doing a lot. I had just complete and total respect, and he's still, in many ways, my favorite conductor to have ever played for, because he knew the music better than anybody. He had a concept and a game plan for every single thing he ever did, and he did every kind of music well. He did everything from the most contemporary works to the most classical works. He did brilliantly, and I love that about him. You know, I never had to go in there and help him realize his vision. He had a vision, and he enabled and empowered us to help him achieve that. And that is that's a great artist right there when you talk about somebody like Lauren Mazel.
Are there times when a conductor, at the risk of belaboring this conductor conversation, because I'm a conductor, you're a conductor, and I'm always interested in these things, are there times when a conductor would, assuming he came in with the right authority, he or she, and had the vision where he might either endear himself to the orchestra or enable himself to learn something by consulting with the players, you know, where he might in some case, this is what I think I want. You may have a better idea of how to achieve what I want.
You're right on with that. A great conductor who has a vision of a piece and has a concept of a piece may have an idea of how to achieve that. However, when you're going from one orchestra to another, each orchestra is different, and each orchestra has an identity and a style. I think if you went back and you listened to the Philadelphia Orchestra in the 50s or in the 40s, you know, with Leopold Stokowski, and then in the 60s with Eugene Ormandy, and then later when they moved to a different hall, when they moved to the Verizon Hall, it changed completely the whole concept of what the Philadelphia Orchestra's style and sound was. They used to call it the Philadelphia string sound. They played in a very dry hall at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. And they played with a certain style that forced everybody in the string section to sustain tremendously, because it was such a dry hall. There was never enough time for resonance in that hall. So they had a very unique, particular sound. Now, if you did certain bowings with that orchestra and you transferred those same bowings to the Chicago Symphony or the New York Philharmonic or the Pittsburgh Symphony, they may not necessarily be useful or productive. So you may have to adjust them a little bit. And in many cases, you know, we'd have a conductor who came in and say, you know, I'm not getting what I want here. What is it that's missing? And then, of course, I would offer a solution, particularly in Boeings, where I'd say, you know, I think what you're looking for is X, and the Boeings that you brought for our orchestra, perhaps we should try something a little different, and I think you'll get the desired result.
Do you have you found, when you've been on the podium, that as somebody who is very accomplished and respected as a violinist generally and a concertmaster in particular, that you have therefore garnered more respect from players simply because of that fact?
That's a great observation. It actually is a two-edged blade. The number one thing is that having done it myself for many years gives me an advantage because I think I know how to deal with musicians better. I understand how they think, and I understand their needs, and I understand how they want to be treated, and I understand the professionalism that is expected, and I think I understand the social aspects. On the other hand, you also find that, you know, especially among people that you know well, sometimes they're a little resentful that you're a peer of theirs in their mind, and then you're up in front of them, and you're asking them to do things, and you have a concept, and you're asking them to adjust their playing to what you feel is right. And for them, it's a big adjustment to take orders from, in their mind, a peer. So I find that it works much better for me to conduct orchestras that are not related to me in any way. You know, this way I can come in with a clean slate, and nobody has preconceived feeling or anything like that. You know what they say, you know, you're not a prophet in your own backyard. So it works much better when I'm conducting orchestras outside of my usual area.
My guest is Andres Cardenas, who is a former concertmaster of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. He is here at the University of Illinois as to be the soloist tonight with Sinfonia da Camera, which will be conducted by his good friend and colleague Ian Hobson. That's tonight at 7:30, a program called From Russia with Love. We'll talk about the program in a little bit, but I promised folks that I would play a little bit of the recording that introduced you to me. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry I missed you before this, but this is a wonderful CD, as I said, called Made in the USA, with music by the likes of Samuel Barber, Victor Herbert, somebody I'd never heard of before, Frederick Knight Logan, Andre Previn, and then a fellow named Cecil Burley, including this brilliant waltz. It's Andres Cardenas, the violinist, with Luz Manriquez, the pianist, on Live and Local. Thank you. delightful little piece by Cecil Burley, an American composer who lived from 1885 to 1980. And this is a Valse Brillante, Opus 19, number 3, if you must know, and a performance by violinist Andres Cardenas with pianist Luz Manriquez. Mr. Cardenas, my guest, this portion of Live and Local here on FM 90.9, where our broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. Well, Mr. Cardenas is here to perform with Sinfonietta Kamra tonight, an all-Russian program that begins with Prokofiev's Classical Symphony, continues with Stravinsky's Firebird Suite, the earlier version of that, and then we'll conclude, somewhat unusually, with the concerto, which more often shows up before the intermission, and it's the one of the more romantic concertos of many that there are, the violin concerto by Tchaikovsky. And we were just talking as we were listening to that last music that it's been so much fun for you to find music, both as a conductor and a violinist, that most people don't do, maybe most people didn't know about. And yet here you are in the concert playing one of the most standard of all the standards. And one of the obvious questions, I guess, is how do you keep a standard from getting stale?
You know, I love this concerto. I think an artist, a real artist, is somebody who, as often as I play this is about my 300th performance of it with orchestra, probably in that area. I was trying to count them not too long ago. And I was thinking, all right, 300 performances of this concerto, and I still love the concerto. There's a couple of things one has to keep in mind. One of them is don't play it too much. I haven't played the concerto in public in about 7 years. I took a break from it. When you do that, then you can come back and look at it very freshly and reassess. And I'm definitely playing it much differently than I did 30 years ago. And certainly, this is the 40th anniversary of when I first learned the concerto, because I learned it when I was 15 years old. And I was looking back and thinking, my gosh, you know, it's been 40 years that I've been playing it. And that's more or less an average of at least 8 times a year that I've been playing it. And there are stretches where I didn't play it, and I played it a lot. I think you just got to keep an open mind. When you play it with different conductors and different orchestras, they bring something different to it. And you have to adjust a little bit and be creative in the moment, too. Once you've had a lot of performances under your belt, you have the freedom to improvise a little bit. I don't mean the notes, but improvise the interpretation a little bit. And you have some freedom because you really know the piece well. And so I'm feeling that with Sinfonia and with Ian. You know, he's done it with Perlman and he's done it with a lot of people. We all play it differently. And so it was, it's kind of fun just to have a fresh look at it and start over again and reassess it. And I actually played it for my students before I came here. I had a little open rehearsal, and I invited people to come and hear 2 run-throughs of it, and I was thinking afterwards how different it was, how it's always different, and how I hear it differently and I feel it differently, and I'm getting older, and as you get older, you start to rethink things, you hear things a little bit differently, and you have life experience that you're bringing to the music that you didn't 30 years ago. So it's an ongoing process, you know, and I'm actually, The one ironic thing about being a violinist is that, as my wonderful teacher, Joseph Gingold, reached his 80s, his knowledge and his experience was so vast. It was so impressive. And yet the body fails you when you're 80. You know, you don't have the fast twitch muscles and the reaction time that it requires to play very fast and accurately. Yet you have all this acquired experience and knowledge, and you can't apply it physically anymore to the instrument. And that is a very unfortunate part of our profession, because when you're 80 and you've acquired all that life experience and everything, to be able to actually execute that would be unbelievable, but it doesn't happen. So that's where teaching, of course, comes in, and that becomes the focus of your legacy is being handed down. But But that's an interesting part of being a violinist, is you acquire all of this. It takes a lot of time to acquire it, and then you really can't implement it when you have all the tools and all the experience.
Yeah. Well, and you said one of the signs of a fine artist is to be able to make things fresh and so on. But I guess it's also one of the signs of a great piece of music is that you don't necessarily have to do anything new to it or with it.
Yeah.
It stands up on its own.
It's very curious because I was once asked by a very famous conductor what I would like to play with him. And I said, gee, I think I'd love to play the Tchaikovsky with you. And his reaction was, why would you want to play that piece? It's a child prodigy concerto. And I had to take a very deep breath and calm myself down because I was really very, I wouldn't say offended, but I was very hurt by that assessment. And I asked him, why do you say that? He said, well, because a lot of 9-year-olds are playing it. And I said, well, that's the exact problem with the work, is that a lot of 9-year-olds are very proficient at playing, but have no clue what the piece is about. And it has become so far off what it's intended to be. And, you know, Tchaikovsky was a very tortured soul, and he was a ballet composer and a man who suffered greatly in his life and possibly even committed suicide. So we're talking about a very tender and very, very emotional person. And I think a 9-year-old, it's hard for them to grasp that. So this particular concerto is very, very close to my heart. And I try to really take a lot of care with it and to bring those elements into the concerto. So it's not a child prodigy concerto by any stretch.
But we don't yet have a recording of you playing this piece, although that will be remedied soon.
You're
recording it with Ian and the Symphony of Varsovia of Poland coming up very soon. I wanted to play another recording of at least a little bit of the slow movement, since you talked about some of the emotional character of it, and this the more tender, I suppose, of the three movements. I didn't ask ahead of time if you like this guy's playing, so I'll tell you who it is after we hear some of
this. I'm sure I can guess.
We'll find out. It's the middle movement of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto here on Live and Local. the first half or so of the second movement of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto. It was played by Maxim Vengerov with the Berlin Philharmonic, led by Claudio Abbado, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. My guest is the man who will play that complete concerto with Sinfonietta Camera under the direction of Ian Hobson tonight at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana, a program called From Russia with Love. I've been very pleased to have Mr. Cardenas as my guest this portion of the show. And sorry you didn't guess. He was really stewing over this and thought, this one's a tough one. Did you like his playing?
I do. Yeah. He's a wonderful violinist. He's a pretty good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
And we were on the Tchaikovsky competition jury together two years ago. And he's a lovely guy. And he had to stop playing for a little while. He had some arm trouble. Mm. And he's back to playing again, which I'm very happy for him. He's doing some conducting as well. And he, of course, is very famous in Europe. And he just got married recently. He has two young children now.
Congratulations to
him. Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, the late Claudio Abbado just died last month, I guess.
Yeah, very sad.
Well, we're going to go out with Andres playing with this Polish orchestra called Sinfonia Varsovia, conducted by Ian Hobson, a recording that was made about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, maybe eight. 2005, of the final movement of another great romantic work, which is the Violin Concerto by Johannes Brahms, who happens to share a birthday with Tchaikovsky. So I guess that knits things together a little bit. Thank you very much for joining us on
Tauruses.
The show.
We're all Tauruses.
Are you there too?
I'm May 2nd, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go, in very good company.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for joining us on the show. And,
thank you.
Have fun tonight.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's some of the final movement of Johannes Brahms' violin concerto. Andres Cardenas, the soloist, with Sinfonia Varsovia, conducted by Ian Hobson. Mr. Hobson and Mr. Cardenas will team up with Sinfonia da Camera at the University of Illinois for a performance of the Tchaikovsky concerto, along with music by Stravinsky and Prokofiev. On tonight's concert, From Russia with Love, it starts at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. I'm Kevin Kelly. This is Live and Local. We have support today from Allerton Park in Monticello, hosting an English weekend at Allerton, February 22nd and 23rd. In the spirit of Downton Abbey, this event takes an in-depth look at the attire, cuisine, architecture, and relationships between servant and master in a post-Edwardian era. Details are available at allerton.illinois.edu. And our next guests come as musicians of St. Matthew Lutheran Church, who are going to be banding together to give a concert Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the church in Urbana. And quite a lot of variety on that program. Two of the musicians were with us last Friday. Well, one sort of with us, the other physically with us, Jeremy House, the pianist, who's also an organist. Jeremy, are you the organist at St. Matt's?
Yes.
Hence your affiliation there. And this was part of a segment in which clarinetist Karen DeBusch was with us previewing a recital she gave just this past Sunday. And by way of a rehearsal recording, Daniel Reck was playing handbells in the studio, a piece that will also be on that concert from the St. Francis Suite of Kevin McChesney, that was a toccata, but he'll be doing some other music there as well. And we also are welcoming Kevin Swartz, tenor, who's going to be performing a couple of pieces on the concert. And I've known Kevin at least a little bit for a lot of years through the Illini Statesman Barbershop Chorus, which I understand is experiencing a resurrection.
That's right. We just had a gentleman approach us wanting to direct the Illini Statesman again. His name is Kevin Hughes, and he is actually sings lead with a quartet called Forefront out of Terre Haute. And but Kevin's up here working now, and wanted to get the Illini Statesman back going again, because we didn't have a chorus really here in town for a while. So that's going again. So if anybody wants to come sing with us, we meet on Monday evenings, every Monday evening at First Christian Church, starting at 7 p.m.
There you go. And this other Kevin has, you mentioned the quartet, but they've got some pretty good credentials.
Yes, they have. They've been competing internationally for several years now. And just at this last competition that they had, they placed fifth. So they are the reigning fifth place international barbershop quartet.
And that's quite a big thing, actually. Well, that by way of a little bit of an aside, but I wanted to give you a chance to give that pitch. Daniel, have you been, tell me your role at St. Matthew.
Certainly. Thanks for having us. I'm the director of handbell music at St. Matthew Lutheran Church, and on this program I'm playing some solo handbell repertoire and then a duet with another handbell musician, and we're having a lot of fun.
And who's the music director at the church?
We don't have a specific music director. We kind of share that as a team. So we have Millie Palmer is the director of our New Life band. Nancy Schneider helps coordinate all of us. And then Jeremy and I also work together on that, along with Hern Hope Park, who is our choral director.
So you were involved then in conceiving of this program, of the concert?
Yeah, I think that all of us were at some level or another, and it was just an opportunity for us to say, hey, our organization's really active in our community. We have a lot of outstanding musicians who do that professionally or who don't do that professionally and just do it as a almost professional hobby, and we wanted to have the opportunity to share that with our community.
Well, I'm looking at the program, and there is some music from musicals on there. There's some spiritual music as well as some spirituals, which are yes and no, the same thing, as you would expect in a program that happens at a church. There's some straight-ahead jazz. You got Lullaby of Birdland. You mentioned Millie Palmer, who's going to be singing that. And then some folk songs, an organ symphony represented on there. You even have a Pinball Wizard from the musical Tommy. I was going to say, I was going to credit that to Elton John, but I guess that was a Who thing, but Elton John was involved in the movie.
That's right. Elton John came along a little bit later and did, of course, a grand piano arrangement and wrote an extra verse. Piano-wise, but went back to Pete Townshend, who wrote the original piece, and said, Pete, I'd like to have another verse. Can you write the words? And he did. And out came the music video, which is an absolute blast to watch if you can find that out online. It's a lot of fun.
How did this piece get on this concert? It appears to be the closing music.
It is. We were looking for a way to bring all of our musicians together and have some fun and get everyone excited. And it's a piece that is kind of special in that it's lightweight and it's versatile, and if Elton John and The Who can do it, and they have totally different styles, then I figured we could do it with some handbells and flutes and guitars and singers and organ and piano and everything else.
I just thought you were going to say, well, if Elton John and The Who could do it, we can do it.
Well, we can.
putting yourselves up on a very different kind of level, but why not? And, an unusual instrumentation. We might as well let you guys do some music. Who's going to go first?
Okay. That's a great question.
Let's say Kevin's going to go first, okay. If that's all right. You're going to do, on the concert, you'll be doing a spiritual called Give Me Jesus. What you're doing for us right now is a tune that many people will know, classical listeners especially, from Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony. Comes from the slow movement. As far as you know, do you know the answer to this? Was he adapting an actual spiritual tune in this symphony?
He was in Iowa at the time. He was only in the country, I think, for 2.5 years at the time. And so he was about 100 years ago or so, he was just taken by, he wanted something new and fresh. And the Negro spiritual at that time was something that he was looking at. So this isn't really a spiritual per se, but something he wrote in that genre.
Okay, inspired by that particular. I remember he said that he thought that if Americans wanted to create an American music, they should do it by looking at the black spiritual, and also music of the American Indian from Native Americans.
That's right. And like I say, he was only in the country, I think, 2.5 years, which some were saying that he was probably homesick at the time.
Probably so, yeah. Hence, this version with words is called Going Home. Is William Arms Fisher the one who wrote the words for this? then?
The words in the adaptation is by him, yes.
Okay. Kevin Swartz is the tenor soloist with pianist Jeremy House, previewing a concert by the musicians of St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Urbana. It's going to be Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock.
All's gain, no more fret nor pain, no more stumbling on the way, no more longing for the day, gone to roam no more. Morning star lights the way, restless dream all done, shadows gone, break all day, real life just begun. There's no break, ain't no end, just a living on, wide awake with a smile, going on and on. Going home, going home, I'm just going home. It's not far, just close by, through an open door. I'm just going.
William Arms Fisher's adaptation of the main theme from the slow movement of the New World Symphony by Antonin Dvorak, Going Home, with tenor Kevin Swartz and pianist Jeremy House. Both will perform that music and another tune on the concert Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Urbana. You're listening to them live in our studio here on Live and Local. Also with us, as we heard earlier, Daniel Reck, who is director of handbells there and has performed solo and lead handbells literally around the world, or at least other places in the world. And we're going to hear a tune that is not, in fact, on this concert, but one that people will certainly know. And before we do it, a real quick... Well, I'm just going to describe this. I mean, people probably know what handbells are, and usually it's a bunch of different people playing bells, maybe two bells one bell in each hand. In this case, you've got what you've called a bell tree, which is literally looks like about 20 bells, maybe 15 bells, hanging from a rack.
There's about 25 up there, yes.
Oh, the 25? Just hanging from the boom of a mic stand. And I'm going to be very interested to see how you play this. So this is a rendition of Amazing Grace.
Thank you.
Daniel Reck striking the handbells with a Jeremy House at the keyboard, an arrangement of Amazing Grace. Who did that, by the way?
That's also Kevin McChesney.
Also Kevin McChesney. And they are but two of the musicians of St. Matthew Lutheran Church who will give a free concert on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. The others include Sam Ginger on organ and piano, flutist Karen DeBush, jazz guitarist Derek Cordoba, vocalists Millie Palmer and Anna Vieira, and in case the music itself is not enough of an enticement, there's homemade treats following. Thank you all very much for coming in, and have fun at your concert on Sunday.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's Live and Local, where programs are made possible with the support of the Friends of WILL and by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. This is 90.9 WILL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Stay tuned for All Things Considered from NPR.